and this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Our station changed up its programming recently. You've heard me say that somewhat frequently recently. We've added Latino USA, Fresh Air Weekend, Bullseye, On the Media, and Freakonomics. It's a program that uncovers the hidden side of everything from economics of sleep to how to become great at, well, just about anything. Host Stephen Dubner talks with Nobel laureates, provocateurs, entrepreneurs, and more in a quest to discover those things you always thought you knew but didn't, and maybe things you never thought you wanted to know but secretly really did. It now airs here on 91.7 on Sundays at noon. Freakonomics host Stephen Dubner joins us now. Stephen, welcome to our show.
Hey, Michael, thank you so much. And I'm so happy to be playing in Cincinnati. So I appreciate that.
We're so happy to have you. I think it's going to be a great addition to our lineup. I know our listeners are going to be excited, but it's possible, of course, because this is your introduction to our market, that a lot of our listeners might not be familiar with your best-selling books and this wildly popular podcast radio show that you host. Now, the words I read describing the show were similar to the ones put out by our marketing department in announcing this change. So I want to ask you to help me elaborate on whether that was correct and tell me a little bit about this quest to discover things we always thought we knew but didn't.
Well, I'll tell you a secret. I think your marketing department got those words from us. So that actually that actually jibes very much and very nicely with the way we think of ourselves. Yeah, there is a it was a sort of not quite a motto but a mantra that we came up with a few years ago, or many years ago, really, when I wrote the first Freakonomics book. It since became a series, and my co-author is Steve Levitt, who's an economist at the University of Chicago. And, you know, the first book was really hard to name because it wasn't obviously a book about anything. It was a book about a lot of things, and what it really was is about using economics, which is a discipline that has a lot of tools, to look at phenomena and ideas that don't necessarily fall within economics. So that's where we kind of got to this idea of, you know, things you always thought you wanted to know, things you always thought you knew but didn't, and things you never thought you wanted to know but do, because we apply the tools of basically economic analysis, or you don't even have to get that, you know, fancy. Basically, just gather data on anything from, you know, food markets to sexual markets to sports and politics and so on. And so really what we try to do with the radio show is it's expanded the mission mightily. You know, we've been doing the show or the podcast now for about 10 years. So We've explored many, many, many areas of modern life, and we try to come at it from a slightly different angle. So it is journalism. I am a journalist. I used to work at, you know, the New York Times and other places like that. But we also really rely on the kind of economic approach of looking at incentives, at really trying to understand why people make the decisions that they do. And sometimes they're obvious and sometimes they're not. And when they're not, we try to gather data to ferret out those incentives, to figure it out, with the purpose ultimately of trying to help us all lead slightly more productive and creative lives and so on. So that's really the gist of it.
And you're not exaggerating when you reference sort of the breadth of topics that you explore. I'm looking at the recent feeds. I was able to have some time to listen to some of these great shows that you've put out in recent weeks. I mean, you've explored obviously COVID-19 and, you know, the impact that it could have on the future of medical research, since we live in this unprecedented race to get one of these things online, but also the economics of sports gambling. You did this great show recently about the NFL and the COVID testing regime that these players are going through. And I'm not a big NFL guy. I'm a passive Bengals fan, of course, but it was fascinating. You had a great show about supermarkets and the role they played in helping America win the Cold War. So I wanted to ask you, you know, you talked about your journalism background. You partner with an economist on a lot of this stuff. How do you go about exploring, you know, these sides of these issues that might be staring us in the face, but then finding a unique conversation to have about them?
All right. So in the interest of full disclosure, I have to say, you say you're a passive Bengals fan. I am actually an active Steelers fan. So if this relationship has to end here, I'll understand. I hope you can countenance my presence.
Don't take it that personally. I think it's important to respect your rivals, and that makes it more beneficial when you beat them, which is rarer and rarer, unfortunately. But there might be some people who tuned out just now.
You know, speaking of rivals, so this is, you're asking where these ideas come from and how we develop them and so on. So I'll just give an example right off of that, talking about rivalries. There was a research paper done a couple years ago by a guy, I can't remember, I want to say he's at Bowling Green, but I may be wrong on that. And he was basically looking at the dynamics of sports rivalries and what they say about the communities that support those teams. So what he identified was essentially that many rivalries are extremely one-way rivalries. So for instance, Notre Dame is the top rival of many, many, many college football teams, but they only consider that they have one or two rivals. You could say in the Steelers-Bengals dynamic, the arrow might be moving in kind of the same direction. So that's actually a really nice example of the things that data can accomplish. So you might think that's a kind of silly and trivial example. How much do we really care about sports rivalries? But the thing that's been remarkable about the last maybe 15 or 20 years, this explosion of big data, you know, I think a lot of it is oversold. People think it is a magic bullet that you press the big data button and it solves all the problems. And that's absurd. Just as, you know, any technology can't solve all the problems it's promoted as solving, whether it's artificial intelligence or and so on. But the fact is that, you know, if you try to understand the incentives that lead people to create these technologies, how these technologies can then be harnessed to produce more good stuff for more of us, that's where I get really excited. So you mentioned this recent episode we did about, will the search for a COVID-19 vaccine change the future of medical research? And this goes way beyond when, I was going to say if and when, hopefully just when we get that vaccine. This goes to, will the process for trying to come up with this vaccine, in other words, dozens, hundreds of different institutions and firms trying to work on this vaccine at once, and the way that it's funded, will that change the way we fund research for cancer drugs and all kinds of other ailments? And so one of the people that we spoke with for that episode, we spoke with a former FDA commissioner. We spoke with the chief medical officer for Moderna, the American firm that's got the firm that's got the first American COVID vaccine trial, COVID vaccine candidate in phase three trials. But we also spoke with an MIT financial economist. And this is kind of what we try to bring to radio that's a little bit different, is this inclusion of different angles of analysis. And he makes the argument that for a relatively small sum of money, if you consider how much suffering there is in the world because of cancer and or heart disease and so on, that for a relatively small amount of money, something like $50 billion, let's say, you could have an investment fund that would totally change the incentives and dynamics of how medical research gets done, which is now typically in very, very, very narrow silos, where research isn't really shared until it can be monetized, where clinical trials aren't put together in a way that are as accessible and useful as they ought to be. And so this is what we're always looking for. I would almost describe us as solutions-based journalism. The only reason I wouldn't is because that sounds like such spinach to eat. It sounds unfun, and we try to actually have fun while we're asking these questions. But most of the questions we ask on the show are in service of our collectively finding better ways to treat each other, to make money without making people miserable, to make more people happy without, doing too many drugs and so on. That's what we're getting at.
And we're talking with Stephen Dubner, host of Freakonomics, which we just added to the WVXU programming lineup Sundays at noon. You can also stream previous episodes at freakonomics.com. And Stephen, this is such a strange time to be I guess, kind of alive. And we were talking before we went on the air that we both feel pretty fortunate that we've been able to keep working during this period and explore a variety of different types of stories. I'm wondering, since your program, Freakonomics, is focused on, really learning, what do you think, as a cultural observer and conversationalist, that we as a community of Americans is learning about ourselves during this very difficult period?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it is, it's not quite an experiment, because to be an experiment, you'd need for there to be a control group, and we don't have that. We're all experiencing this pandemic. That said, there are places that differ from one another, and we've already started to learn a lot about the differences in China, for instance. In the very beginning, because they shut down early, much earlier than the rest of us, there were researchers who went in and measured air pollution in the immediate aftermath of the shutdowns, and found that there was so much less pollution in China that it was responsible for saving and or extending many, 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 many more lives than were claimed by COVID-19. So we're looking at a situation where there are so many wild inputs that there will certainly be some interesting outputs. Some of them will be bad. Some of them will be good. Some of them you may not care about. Obviously, one of the biggest changes is how so many people are working from home. Will big employers who required their employees, especially office jobs, who typically were requiring those employees to come in 5 days a week, will they be able to get employees back 5 days a week? I think the answer to that is maybe not, especially in the beginning. On the other hand, I could be totally wrong. The future is really hard to predict. One other prediction that I've been speaking about with some psychologists and others is that I guess what you'd call the psychological trauma that we're experiencing societally from COVID, while we know that it's a terribly difficult situation, that the trauma that we are experiencing will actually end up being probably much less and much long-term damaging for many people than we suspect. And the reason that psychologists will make that argument is because there's one really big overlooked input that many, many, many people have, not everyone, but many, 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 which is a huge reservoir of resilience, learning to be gritty, learning to dig deep and to deal with situations that you couldn't have even imagined, adapting with skills that you didn't know you had, that you didn't know you would ever need. But it is kind of a feature of humans. Again, we are a wild species. We've done a lot of things that wouldn't have been predicted 5, 10,000 years ago. And so I do think, or maybe think is too strong a word, maybe hope, that this will turn out to be a true prediction, which is that our collective resilience is large enough that when we do get past it, we will not only, wipe our brow and say, whew, it was really bad, but it could have been worse. Not only will we do that, but that we will actually learn, grow, plan, and prevent, the next terrible thing that's bound to happen.
Stephen, I haven't had a guest like in the studio with me since March, and I'm assuming that's similar for you. And we're learning all these alternative ways to deliver, mostly quality sound with some hiccups. And so, as you know, workplaces may be permanently disrupted. We don't know yet, but I know you used to do some live shows in addition to your radio show in theaters, and I imagine that's because you enjoy doing that. My hunch is that people are going to be hungry to get back to that. What do you think about when those opportunities return? Do you think people are going to be slow to that, or is it something that we miss so much that we're going to rush back?
I do think that will be slow. I mean, I say this as someone who lives in New York City, where, in the best of times, a Broadway theater felt like a big germ box. It's very, very, very tight. And I think that kind of activity is going to take a good while to come back, because, it's a complicated future that we've got in front of us with, first of all, you have to have an efficacious vaccine, you have to have a safe vaccine, and you have to have a vaccine that enough people are going to want to take for it to work across society. So I think that's going to take a while. And I think even after that's achieved, I do think that a lot of people have found that they are pretty successful in small group settings. Now, you're asking the wrong guy, though, because I'm a writer. Writers are people who are really happy not being around other people. I mean, that's partly why I became a writer. So, you know, I was social distancing long before social distancing was a thing. But even I like to come out of my shell. And yes, I love these live shows. And my favorite thing is, although some theaters that we did it prevented us from making this announcement, we would usually announce at the beginning or the end of a show, hey, this is where we're going for drinks afterwards, so please join us. And to meet listeners is something, you know, when you're making a podcast and radio show in New York City, you don't get the chance to do all that much. So I desperately want some of that. I don't need a ton, Michael, but I want some of that, yeah.
I agree wholeheartedly with all that. I love that. And until we can see Stephen Dubner live again, you can always listen to his show Freakonomics on Sundays right here on 91.7 WVXU. It airs at noon now, and you can stream other episodes at freakonomics.com. Stephen, this was a pleasure. I'm so glad you could take some time to talk with us, and we're so glad to have you in our lineup now.
Well, it's really my pleasure. And if I may, I would just like to give our email address because I would love to know what Cincinnati listeners think of our show, good, bad, or indifferent, because we really do try to incorporate feedback.
Oh, and they'll let you know. I'm gonna tell you right now. They're going to let you know.
So we are at radio@freakonomics.com. We don't respond to every email, but we do read everyone. And I'd really appreciate hearing from you. And I very much hope that you enjoy our show. And I thank you for taking it on.
We'll put a link to that email address at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Michael.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Marks.